everybody, Marcus here. Now I want to remind everybody of our pact that for every 1,000 subscribers I receive on this channel, I will give away one copy of CyberLink's PowerDirector 13 Ultra software. So please consider liking this video, sharing it, subscribing, or even just listening to the very end. In this video, I wanted to explore the origin of the social justice warrior. Now, before we can begin, let's make a distinction between origin and function. Perhaps the best way to describe the difference is to look at how someone would answer a different question that's in a similar spirit. What is the origin of the post-it note? Now, a post-it note, for those who may know them by another name, are these small, usually square pieces of paper with the top 10% of one of the edges lined with a very weak glue. The piece of paper is usually written on and stuck to something to serve as a reminder. Now, we can answer the question as to the origin of the post-it note by saying that someone prone to writing down little reminders for himself wanted a way to leave them in a place most appropriate for the reminder. This is an answer that considers the function of the post-it note as the origin. However, the story of the post-it note is one of a failed experiment. You see, a scientist was attempting to create a super strong adhesive, but in his failure, created the type of adhesive that is now used in post-it notes. See, the origin of the post-it note had nothing to do with the function of the post-it note. Its function was applying a purpose to something that came about for completely unrelated reasons. It is this distinction that I want us to keep in mind when we look at the origin, as opposed to the function, of the social justice warrior. You know, we say that the function of the social justice warrior is to fight social injustice wherever it may appear. And as such, we all too quickly jump to the conclusion that the origin must be social injustice. I argue that the social justice warrior is really an application of function to a type of person who comes into being for completely unrelated causes. At this point, let us digress a little and talk about what we mean when we throw out the label social justice warrior. So this is a pejorative term as we come to know it. This is a person that fights social injustice and also finds injustice in social phenomenon where many others do not see it. As the social phenomenon objectively exists, the social justice warrior is justified in the fact that he has in fact identified something as a social phenomenon, but then he does some, you know, batshit insane mental gymnastics to deem that phenomenon as something unjust and in need of eradication. So, now I think we have gotten to the core of the original question, the question of what is the origin of the social justice warrior? We can rephrase this to ask, what is the origin of the attitude in people we call pejoratively as social justice warriors in coming up with these batshit insane reasons to condemn certain social phenomena? You know, how the hell does a person come into existence who can conceive of nonsense like manspreading? I mean, how the hell does a mind form that would look at men peeing standing up as a discrimination? I mean, how the fuck can an adult truly and honestly rationalize to themselves that a shirt with a picture of scantily clad women keeps women out of STEM fields? I mean, these people are not trolling. They have fully internalized the truth of what they are saying. I mean, these issues are as serious to them as murder. Their sincerity cannot be understated. Now, Nietzsche has a great aphorism that describes, but more interestingly, anticipates the social justice warrior. It is an excerpt from Aphorism 44 from the Helen Zimmer translation of Beyond Good and Evil. If you are interested, you can find the whole book for free on the Gutenberg Project. So just type in Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche, Gutenberg Project into Google, and you'll be able to easily find it. All right, here we go. In every country of Europe, and the same in America, there is at present something which makes an abuse of this name a very narrow, prepossessed, enchained class of spirits who desire almost the opposite of what our intentions and instincts prompt. Not to mention that in respect to the new philosophers who are appearing, they must still more be closed windows and bolted doors. Briefly and regrettably, they belong to the levelers. These wrongly named free spirits, as glib-tongued and scribe-fingered slaves of the democratic taste and its modern ideas, all of them men without solitude, without personal solitude, blunt, honest fellows to whom neither courage nor honorable conduct ought to be denied, only they are not free. and are ludicrously superficial, especially in their innate partiality for seeing the cause of almost all human misery and failure in the old forms in which society has hitherto existed, a notion which happily inverts the truth entirely. What they would fain attain with all their strength is the universal, green-meadowed happiness of the herd, together with security, safety, comfort, and alleviation of life for everyone. Their two most frequently chanted songs and doctrines are called equality of rights and sympathy with all sufferers. And suffering itself is looked upon by them as something which must be done away with. Now, there is a lot going on in this description, but we can immediately see that Nietzsche is talking about social justice warriors. Remember, he is writing this before 1886, you know, long before the Tumblr crazies, but well in anticipation that they're on the way. Nietzsche says that these people on the surface appear as free spirits, you know, fighting the establishment and so on, but quickly wants to distance this type of person from what Nietzsche concedes as a free spirit, who he also sometimes refers to as the philosopher of tomorrow. Now, the social justice warrior type he called a leveler, a glib-tongued and scribe-fingered slave of the democratic taste and its modern ideas. Basically, someone who is politically correct. He says they are not free and are ludicrously superficial, especially in their innate partiality for seeing the cause of almost all human misery and failures in the old forms in which society has hitherto existed. So these people blame culture for all the problems that lead to human suffering. I mean, this is sounding familiar, isn't it? What these people are trying to do is attain a green meadow happiness of the herd, together with security, safety, comfort, and alleviation of life for everyone. See, the word herd is very important because it qualifies the type of comfort, the type of security, and the type of alleviation of life that is to be achieved. They want everyone to be exactly the same. No one member of the herd is allowed to stand out in any way. Safety, comfort, and security come from sameness. No dissenting opinions, no differentiating qualities between people that might make someone uncomfortable, and the security of knowing that everyone agrees with you. Nietzsche then finishes with, their two most frequently chanted songs and doctrines are called equality of rights and sympathy with all sufferers. And suffering itself is looked upon by them as something which must be done away with. Now, you might ask yourself why Nietzsche would have a problem with doing away with suffering. I mean, after all, would that not be a good thing? I mean, Nietzsche does not think so. He sees suffering as something that brings about growth and betterment. It's a different way of saying that we learn through our mistakes, and we can only come to know that something was a mistake because we suffered some consequence. By eliminating suffering, we eliminate consequences, and as such, we end up with a world full of spoiled princesses, and nobody wants that. It's not good for the spoiled princess, and it's not good for anyone who has to interact with her. So, this aphorism seems to have described what to me is a spot-on definition of a social justice warrior, but it does not take us any closer to figuring out how they came about. To answer that, I will turn to aphorism 201 from Beyond Good and Evil. This aphorism, I will read one small section at a time and comment throughout, as there's a great deal going on and it can't really be understood with one reading unless it's explained along the way. All right, the aphorism starts as follows. As long as the utility which determines moral estimates is only gregarious utility, as long as the preservation of the community is only kept in view, and the immoral is sought precisely and exclusively in what seems dangerous to the maintenance of the community, there can be no morality of love to one's neighbor. So Nietzsche thinks that when the people of a society are primarily concerned about the safety and well-being of the community as a whole, and they are not just looking out for their own interests, then what those people will consider good or moral will be those things that the whole community benefits from. So it's the sentiment JFK expressed in his famous line, you know, think not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. But it goes a little further and adds, and if you can't do anything for your country, then get the fuck out, because we can't afford a dead weight burden like you. In this attitude, you can clearly see there is no love of one's neighbor. There can't be. The society throws out useless members because they are a danger to the group as a whole. The weak are culled. Strength is moral. Weakness is immoral. Nietzsche tempers this overall sentiment of the people, though. I mean, he says, granted, even that there is already a little constant exercise of consideration, sympathy, fairness, gentleness, and mutual assistance, granted that even in this condition of society, all those instincts are already active, which are latterly distinguished by honorable names as virtues, and eventually almost coincide with the conception morality. In that period, they do not as yet belong to the domain of moral valuations. They are still ultra-moral. So Nietzsche is saying that these people that value above all those qualities in a person that benefit the society as a whole are not devoid of the sentiments needed to love your neighbor. So you can imagine two guys walking down the street and they see a bum begging for money. No one would blink twice if one of them spit on the bum, you know, gave him a kick and told him to get a job. No, some might even laugh who witnessed it. You see, the bum as a detriment to the group, and as such don't value him. If one of those guys, you know, overcome with pity, however, throws the bum a dollar, you can imagine his friend's reactions, you know, the hell are you giving that bum money? I mean, what the hell is wrong with you? Oh, you know, look how pathetic he is. Ah, fuck it, let the wino have another drink. Another scenario you can imagine is that a guy sees his friend hit rough times, and would be apt to house him for a short while, you know, to get back on his feet. I mean, the help, however, would come only because the person in need is a friend, and only because the person in need is perceived as someone who will get back on their feet. So, in this way, we see some of the love your neighbor behavior, but even those people that exhibit some charitable actions won't consider opening a homeless shelter as a good idea. You see, making sure everyone is taken care of by society runs contrary to the value that people are meant to take care of society. Since a bum can't even take care of himself, not only is he worthless to society, but it is an absurd notion that society should take care of him, as this is backwards to how things are supposed to work. So, Nietzsche describes how these acts of kindness are viewed in the following passage. A sympathetic action, for instance, is neither called good nor bad, moral nor immoral. In the best period of the Romans, and should it be praised, a sort of resentful disdain is compatible with this praise. Even at the best, directly, the sympathetic action is compared with one which contributes to the welfare of the whole, to the res publica. This whole sentiment can be summed up as follows. Yeah, I suppose if we feed some of these bums, then they could probably, you know, won't go around robbing us good folk. Though I still say we should chase them out of the city. You know, what Nietzsche says next is very interesting, though. He says, after all, love to our neighbor is always a secondary matter, partly conventional and arbitrarily manifested in relation to our fear of our neighbor. After the fabric of society seems on the whole established and secured against external dangers, it is this fear of our neighbor which again creates new perspectives of moral valuation. You see, this is the society that we are living in now, in the developed nations at least. Once it becomes clear that no, in fact, the Russians are not coming, we stop fearing for the destruction of freedom and democracy. You know, the whole is secured. There is no more external danger, at least none that is perceived or feared. So at this point, that bum on the street that was someone you would spit on because his existence was only going to slow us down when the Russians came, that bum now becomes only a nuisance. The news is no longer filled with Russians maneuvering armies. No, the news is filled with stories of the homeless robbing and killing people. So who do the people begin to fear? They begin to fear others within society. So people start demanding something is done about these fucking bums. A good citizen can't sleep in their own bed at night anymore without worrying that some homeless drifter will just barge in and slit his throat. I mean, some might even take to locking their doors at night. What kind of world is this turning into? So the old attitude resurfaces. Well, if they just had some food and somewhere to go, Maybe they'll stop robbing and murdering us good folk. The citizens rally. Charities spring up. Shelters are provisioned. Soup kitchens are built. And once many of these bums are herded into these places, they are even talked to. And when they are talked to, you start hearing stories about the poor man who lost his job, could not find a new one, and ended up a bum. Higher and higher, these sorts of sob stories permeate the media. Man worked 30 years at factory, loses job, and becomes homeless. Mother of three could not afford food and rent on meager salary, becomes homeless. And on and on. Once again, the people are outraged. How can a hard-working, God-fearing, tax-paying, voting citizen end up like this? This could happen to me. This could happen to my children. These are good people. They can't be treated like this. What kind of society is this? What is the government doing about this? Ah, and now we see the shift in values from what you can do for your country to what can your country do for you. So as Nietzsche said, love for our neighbor sprung out of our fear of our neighbor. The bum was first feared, then he became every man. He became someone that a useful citizen related with, and as the useful citizen saw himself as useful, and the bum like him, the bum too became useful. The bum became that friend who was just down on his luck, and with only a little help, would get back to being productive. But unlike before, now it was no longer down to individuals in choosing to help their down-on-their-luck friend. It was now the responsibility of the government, namely every taxpayer, to help this friend. This was the new perspective on moral valuations, as Nietzsche indicates. But much more happened in society than just a change in our perspective of individuals down on their luck. No, much more. Nietzsche carries on and says, certain strong and dangerous instincts, such as the love of enterprise, foolhardiness, revengefulness, astuteness, rapacity, and love of power, which up till then had not only to be honored from the point of view of general utility, under other names, of course, than those here given, but had to be fostered and cultivated, because they were perpetually required in the common danger against the common enemies, are now felt in their dangerousness to be doubly strong, when the outlets for them are lacking, and are gradually branded as immoral and given over to calumny. See, when the Russians were still coming, we cherished the art of the soldier. Mothers would tell their sons to eat their meat to become big and strong and praise their little soldier, who would one day grow up like his brother and join the Navy. Men of enterprise were praised. Look at Henry Ford. You don't see those damn Ruskies with men like that. You don't see commies inventing refrigerators, do you? Righteous anger and patriotism was looked upon favorably. Come to America. This is the land of opportunity. Vengefulness was treasured. In every example of the country rallying behind a threat that hits its shores, you see it. Pearl Harbor, 9/11. They come to our land and fuck with our families? Oh, you motherfuckers will pay. These qualities were cultivated in children. These were the standards you used to see if you raised a good son. But these qualities had a target external to society. These qualities were meant to be unleashed against the enemies of the community, of the government, of the country. And, as long as there was an enemy, these qualities persisted. You see, people knew these qualities had viciousness about them, but it was a good thing because we are supposed to be vicious against our enemies. I mean, what, are you just going to lay down and die? Are you going to fight tanks with hugs and sensitivity? No, fuck no. You're going to fight the enemy with patriotism, vengefulness, strength, ingenuity, economic prosperity. That is what you will fight with. But what happens when the enemy is defeated and nothing takes its place? Well, as Nietzsche says, these qualities are now felt in their dangerousness to be doubly strong, when the outlets for them are lacking and are gradually branded as immoral and given over to calumny. Today, it's, son, eat your tofu because eating meat is destructive to the environment, and hurry up because we're going to be late to the military spending protest, and for the love of God, no. For the 100th time, you can't play football. It's too dangerous. Yeah, Ford, you know, and all those massive corporations, ugh, they're just fucking over the working man with those low wages. I mean, why do people drive cars anyways? Don't they know how bad it is for the environment? Now, fuck them, I'm walking. And what happened to fuck China, buy American? Well, all I can say is, why do you have to be so angry? It's not good for your health, you know. You know, are you sure you don't have anger issues? You know they have programs for that now. And why do you care where stuff is made anyway? I mean, countries are just dirt. Are you racist against Asians or something? With no external enemy, these same qualities that once served to protect the community as a whole are now perceived as dangerous to the community. With no external outlet, they can only be unleashed on other members of society. I mean, when you look at those who protested Vietnam, do you think for one moment any one of them would be there picketing if that war was being fought on American soil? Was there ever a moment of fear in any of those protesters? Did any of them believe that that war could carry out of Vietnam and into America? Well, of course not. Nothing threatened the security of their society. They did not fear an external enemy. They were attacking the very same qualities they would be praising if that war took place in America. It would not even matter who started the war. They would want to see those Vietnamese dead all the same. As with the bum, now bored with tales of the homeless, now bored with issuing updates on the various government programs being put into place, you know, pension plans, welfare, subsidized living, and so on, the media starts more so than ever to report on violent crimes. They hear how the murderer was angry and so proclaimed that anger did the killing and not the murder. Here, once again, the outrage. Studies are done. Over and over, violence and anger go hand in hand. Something must be done. People begin to fear anger itself. Once again, citizens rally, programs are set up, and in the final analysis, the government is called upon. Mental health comes under subsidy. Psychology and psychiatry businesses boom. Anger has been pathologized. One by one, those qualities that used to be good succumb to medication, therapies, self-help books, and blamed as the cause of all societal woes. So fear of one's neighbor extended to qualities in people. What was previously good character became bad. What was strength became weakness. And what was valued became immoral. The contrary instincts and inclinations now attain to moral honor. The gregarious instinct gradually draws its conclusion. How much or how little dangerousness to the community or to equality is contained in an opinion, a condition, an emotion, a disposition, or an endowment, that is now the moral perspective. Here again, fear is the mother of morals. And so in this way, we see the death of those qualities that protect a community as a whole, and the rise of the individual and their equality with all other individuals. Where it was only us, it is now you, me, and that other guy over there. But it just does not stop. With the destruction of those qualities that protect the community go qualities that make men great. So Nietzsche writes, "It is by the loftiest and strongest instincts, when they break out passionately and carry the individual far above and beyond the average, and the low level of the gregarious conscience, that the self-reliance of the community is destroyed, its belief in itself, its backbone, as it were, breaks. Consequently, these very instincts will be most branded and defamed. The lofty independent spirituality, the will to stand alone, and even the cogent reason are felt to be dangerous. Everything that elevates the individual above the herd and is a source of fear to the neighbor is henceforth called evil. The tolerant, unassuming, self-adapting, self-equalizing disposition, the mediocrity of desires, attains to moral distinction and honor. The self-reliance of the community was dependent on those qualities which are now deemed immoral. How can a society defend itself if it cannot produce the sort of person who can defend it? When the protective qualities went, so did the people who possessed them, and so in that way did its backbone break. Can a society that cannot defend itself against foreign invaders be called self-reliant? Surely not. But it gets even better. Everything that elevates the individual above the herd and is a source of fear to the neighbor is henceforth called evil. See, it's no longer sufficient to be a calm and considerate individual. No, 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 no. You can't be any better than anyone else either. But you can't directly crush the ambitious and competitive spirit. No, what you must crush is victory. Games where you don't keep score or can't lose, ribbons for participation, you know, school material dumbed down to the lowest common denominator. That's what you can do. What you do is you make it so unrewarding to even participate that your spirit is crushed and you succumb to apathy. In fact, thinking you are better, hell, even demonstrating you are better, is forbidden. But what are you allowed to be then? Nay, what are you praised for? The tolerant, unassuming, self-adapting, self-equalizing disposition. The mediocrity. You are praised to be mediocre. This wins honor. And you must, of course, be self-equalizing. You must check your privilege. For it is in no way possible you can achieve more when your capabilities are equal to everybody else. But if you do, it must be taken away from you because those are illicit gains. You know, it's a sad day when I hear from my 8th grade nephew, you know, how students in his class rejoice at just passing. You know, how they advertise the pride their parents will feel when they bring home a 50% result on a test. You know, how anything greater than a 50% is viewed as wasted effort because you don't pass any more with 100% than with a 50. Sameness. This is what is natural. Every form of distinction needs to be eliminated. If they cannot be eliminated directly, you know, like the ambition or competitive spirit, they must be crushed indirectly. No group of people can differ from any other. No matter how the demographic is cut up, the numbers must be identical. After all, how can we all not be the same if we are all equal? And why must we be all equal? Because it is terrifying to think you might not be as great as you think you are. And the sight of anyone who has more of anything, more of the things you don't even want, that sight, this sight is a horror amongst horrors, and you tremble in fear, until that moment when you realize you are not equal. But how can he have more than me, if we are equal? That thief, he has stolen it. That terror turns to rage at the injustice right in front of their eyes. But how did he steal it? Through privilege. He is not only a thief, but of the worst kind, one who does not know he is a thief. But why must equality always lower and never elevate? Why is the lowest common denominator the bar? Well, because an idiot cannot be made smart, but a smart man can be made an idiot. The lower cannot be made the higher, but the higher can be beaten down. And so the victory of equality is the victory of the worst in us. But still, it gets worse than this. Finally, under very peaceful circumstances, there's always less opportunity and necessity for training the feelings of severity and rigor. And now every form of severity, even injustice, begins to disturb the conscience. A lofty and rigorous nobleness and self-responsibility almost offends and awakens distrust. The lamb, and still more, the sheep, wins respect. There's a point of diseased mellowness and effeminacy in the history of society, at which society itself takes the part of him who injures it, the part of the criminal, and does so, in fact, seriously and honestly. To punish appears to it to be somehow unfair. It is certain that the idea of punishment and the obligation to punish are then painful and alarming to people. Is it not sufficient if the criminal be rendered harmless? Why should we still punish? Punishment itself is terrible. With these questions, gregarious morality, the morality of fear, draws its ultimate conclusion. See, this is a very critical passage that Nietzsche presents. It starts by saying that under very peaceful circumstances, there's always less opportunity and necessity for training the feelings to severity and rigor. Now, this observation explains to us the reason why the quality of people is circling down the toilet, as opposed to merely circling the toilet. When a man drinks large quantities of beer on a regular basis for a long period of time, he develops a tolerance. So at the peak of his tolerance, it would take him, say, 10 pints to get him drunk. It is only when he is drunk after 10 pints will he start to be stupid. One pint won't faze him. 3 pints won't faze him. Hell, even after 9 pints, he is still composed, but you can tell he is just barely keeping it together. Well, if his supply of alcohol is reduced, his tolerance will go down. Now, he will turn stupid after 9 pints. With a further reduction of alcohol, it would only take 8 pints and so on, until even a sip of beer will make him retarded. Now, let us say that the external enemy, the Russians, was that tolerance of 10 pints. That it took something truly big, you know, something comparable to the fear of the destruction of your nation to cause you to be outraged. Now, eliminate this external enemy and you are down to 9 pints. Get rid of the homeless, you are left with 8, and so forth. As Nietzsche said, as society grows more peaceful and comfortable, the tolerance for what can cause a man fear goes down. So in a war-torn country, they really are not bothered by inequality. You know, the concern for whether or not there's a pay gap between male scavengers and female scavengers due to male privilege of being able to carry more, you know, that really does not faze them. In fact, I'm quite confident that someone who would raise this concern in such a country would probably be exiled from the group for being a retarded liability. Now, they have other shit to fear than the pay gap. They would welcome the pay gap if the bombs stopped falling. But with every comfort and every concession granted, tolerance goes down. The man who feared that the Russians were coming, but then came to his security that they are not, retained his 10-pint tolerance. His son, having been born later, never experienced the Russian threat, so his tolerance was at 9. So the son all of a sudden saw all the shit that needed fixing that his father considered just, you know, day-to-day stuff. So as the father in his generation died, the son in his 9-pint generation took the reins and fixed society. The son of the son then was born into an 8-pint tolerant world, and the cycle repeats itself. But when you start getting to that 2 to 3 pint tolerance, you're going to have a whole lot of shit bothering you. As the tolerance decreases, the number of items of bother on the lower level is greater than the number of items on the one above it. I mean, the fear of the destruction of your country is a single fear, from probably one source. The level on which fear of being called a bad name exists, however, has tons of sources of problems, and also has a large frequency of occurrences of these problems. So as tolerance goes down, the perception of the world becoming more unjust increases. At 10 pints tolerance, there's only one thing that needs to be fixed, the defeat of the external enemy. At 9 pints, there are, say, 2 things, like homelessness and pensions. At 8 pints, we are getting to like 10 things at this level, you know, anger, pride, ambition, and so on. You know, I think you get the picture. At 1 point, however, the tolerance is so low that we start to see punishment itself as intolerable. This, sadly, is where we are right now. You know, though Nietzsche only uses the word punishment, it should be noted that I also read in consequences to fall under this label. You know, after all, an unpleasant consequence is a punishment for bad action. Nietzsche says there is a point at which society itself takes the part of him who injures it. This means that society sides with those people who are themselves harming society, like Stockholm Syndrome, you know, where the victim sides with the abductor. This can be seen happening with eliminating corporal punishment from schools, you know, in prison reforms attempting to rehabilitate prisoners with the absurd notion put out that even women's prisons should be abolished altogether. You know, to the most ridiculous example of that, Ottawa law professor Sheehy, in advocating that wives should just murder their abusive husbands with no recourse from the law. I mean, in society at large, consequences are being eliminated. With the advent of birth control, the consequence of sex has been removed. But no one ever asked, should it be removed, even if it could? It used to be that if you fail a course in school, you fail the year and need to repeat the whole year. Then you only need to repeat the course. Finally, you now get to retake the exams. You know, this progressive elimination of consequences leads into Nietzsche's final point and the conclusion of the aphorism. If one could at all do away with danger, the cause of fear, one would have done away with this immorality at the same time. It would no longer be necessary. It would not consider itself any longer necessary. Whoever examines the conscience of the present-day European will always elicit the same imperative from its thousand-fold moral folds and hidden recesses, the imperative of the timidity of the herd. We wish that some time or other there may be nothing more to fear. Some time or other, the will and the way thereto is nowadays called progress all over Europe. So as we see the values that originated from fear wish to exterminate themselves, the goal to eliminate all fear, if achieved, will eliminate the need for the values that would manifest such an end. However, we know that this is not possible. We wish that some time or other there may be nothing more to fear. How can it be possible to achieve this unless we eliminate the human capacity for fear itself? I mean, and this we know to be impossible. But there are emotional states immune to fear. One is never afraid when one is angry. Also, when one pities, one is not afraid. After all, you must elevate yourself above that which you pity, and you cannot fear that which is beneath you. And these are the two feelings that permeate social justice warriors. Those they cannot pity, they get angry at, in both cases subduing their fear. What this aphorism comes to show us is a chain of events and the psychological shifts that take place between a value system focused on the survival of the community to one that, absent an external enemy, makes the community the enemy. This is the origin of the social justice warrior, this shift of values. The social justice warrior is an inevitable consequence of such a society and will always come about in such a society. This is clearly different from the function of the social justice warrior, as we originally said. The function of a social justice warrior could mislead us into believing that the presence of social injustice was the origin of the social justice warrior. But as it turns out, this is not the case. What also needs to be noted here is that the social justice warrior is not a feminist, though a feminist is a social justice warrior. There's nothing inherent in the origin of the social justice warrior suggesting the issues that feminist espouses. I mean, animal rights, environmental issues, and the countless other causes fall under the same type of person, with social justice merely being one or two pints of tolerance lower, therefore much more absurd to anyone of higher tolerance. It is this lack of training to the feeling of severity and rigor, you know, this growing capacity in succumbing to an ever-widening array of objects of fear that brings into existence this sort of being we now see in the lunacy of the social justice warrior. They sublimate their fear into anger and pity and lash out at the source. As they eliminate one source, the next round will find something to fear in a more absurd place. This can easily be observed in the fact that the most righteous of the bunch come from upper middle class or wealthy families. Though we can witness some coming from poorer backgrounds, they tend to be less fanatical, though still, the presence of social justice warriors in humbler surroundings still goes to show how good those humble surroundings are compared to the past. The extent of the radicalization is inversely proportional to the suffering a social justice warrior has experienced in their life. This also tends to explain why the countries with the highest living standards tend to breed this type of person in large quantities. I mean, Sweden and Canada are both known for their high standard of living, and they are both prominent sources of social justice warriors. You know, the great irony is that to eliminate these sorts of people, suffering needs to be increased and not decreased. But this is the opposite of what social justice warriors strive towards. Social justice warriors in this way breed more social justice warriors, more radical ones to be precise. The irony is that the life of a social justice warrior is a miserable one. I mean, it necessarily needs to be full of fear. Not only this, but the community as a whole is worsened for the changes they make. The community loses the ability to defend itself and inevitably will succumb to an external invader, you know, whether military or cultural, because such a community is no longer capable of bringing into existence the sort of people who can defend it. As long as fear is the mother of our morality, as long as suffering is viewed with contempt, all suffering will be viewed with contempt. All suffering will be viewed as senseless, unjustified, evil, even the natural suffering that comes from consequences of bad action. And while this holds true, we will always have social justice warriors, and they will always find phantoms of injustice to fight against. Thanks for listening. Go team.